May it please the Court, my name is Joseph Rhodes, and I'm here on behalf of Appellees and Cross Appellants. As always, it's an honor and a privilege to stand before this honorable court. I would like to take the opportunity to introduce to the court my colleague, Jerome H. Block, of the law firm of Levy, Phillips, and Konigsberg, New York City, New York, who will be presenting the argument on behalf of appellees and cross appellants.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Good morning.
Morning. Or back to the afternoon.
Yes, I'm Beth Filoki. May it please the Court, I'm Beth Filoki. I'm here today on behalf of Dana Companies, LLC, and I'm pleased to introduce to the Court at this time Valerie Ross and William Hanlon, both from the firm of Goodwin & Procter in Washington, D.C. Ms. Ross is going to present the argument for Dana, the appellant and the cross appellant.
Welcome to the Court.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. Good afternoon. Timothy House, CEO of Young Conaway, Stargett & Taylor. I would be presenting argument for Zoom Performance Products, a trade name of Perfection High Test. And with me today is my colleague, William Gamgort.
Good afternoon. And before I start the clock, as I understand it, you're going to have a total of 14 minutes, and you'd like 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So when the clock is green, everything's fine. When it turns yellow, you're into your 4 minutes, and you can continue, but you will be using the 4 minutes you want to reserve.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
You're welcome.
May it please the Court. This appeal involves a jury verdict in an asbestos case that irrationally ignored undisputed evidence by finding exposure to asbestos from products made or sold by Dana, Zoom, and 9 other companies, but only imposing liability on Dana and Zoom, even though the conduct of the 9 others was not materially any different. And at a minimum, that inconsistent verdict must be set aside and the case remanded for a new trial. The evidence as to the non-parties was as follows. There was evidence that Bruce and Elizabeth Henderson were exposed to asbestos from the products manufactured by those non-parties or sold by those non-parties, and the jury, in fact, so found. There was unrebutted testimony from plaintiff's expert, Dr. Castleman, establishing that the non-parties knew or should have known of the hazards of asbestos prior to the relevant time period. And there was unrebutted testimony from Bruce Henderson, which established that the non-parties failed to warn of the hazards of asbestos. And because it ignored this uncontroverted evidence, the jury verdict cannot stand. The plaintiffs essentially make 2 arguments as to why a new trial is nonetheless not required. They argue first that Dana did not introduce evidence relating to the issue of non-party liability. But that's a red herring, because Dana was entitled to rely on evidence that the plaintiffs introduced that established the non-party liability. And in any event, Dana, in fact, did offer evidence relating to the question of non-party liability.
Was the jury asked to expressly address this issue?
They were. The jury instructions instructed the jury as to the question of non-party liability, and the verdict sheet had separate questions asking about exposure, liability, and causation for actually 13 non-parties. And they answered the exposure question yes as to 9 non-parties who were, like Dana and Zoom, manufacturers and suppliers of automotive products. And then they also answered the exposure question yes for another company, Johns Manville, which was on the verdict sheet for a different reason.
So this issue was considered by the jury and rejected?
The question of liability, yes, Your Honor. The question of exposure was accepted by the jury.
Do I understand it that they had a list of 13 names and they put yes down a few times, but they put down no for the other non-parties?
They put down yes for 9 or for 10 non-parties, no for 3 non-parties on the exposure question, and then they answered no as to 9 of those non-parties on the liability questions and didn't answer the causation questions for those 9 non-parties. They answered yes as to Johns Manville for exposure, liability, and causation.
So they made an individual determination. It wasn't that they had to pick the names themselves. And your argument on appeal is the individual determination made by the jury is contrary to the record evidence.
That is correct, Your Honor. Now, the plaintiffs second argument is that the jury heard more evidence as to the liability of Dana and Zoom than they heard about the non-parties. And that's another red herring, because the volume of the evidence doesn't matter, whereas here the relevant evidence is entirely unrebutted. And in any event, the jury did hear plentiful evidence as to the non-parties. They heard, as I said, from Dr. Castleman, that the non-parties knew or should have known of the hazards of asbestos prior to the relevant time period. And as to the question of failure to warn, they heard the testimony of Bruce Henderson that there were no warnings on any of the products at issue, made or sold by these non-parties, that he was unaware of the hazards of asbestos until the early 1980s, after he last worked with any of the products made or sold by these companies, and that had he known of the hazards of asbestos when he was working with these products, he would have taken precautions. But as his description of his work with those products made clear, he never, in fact, took such precautions. And the only reasonable inference to be drawn from that testimony was that the non-parties failed to warn.
Well, there was some evidence of warnings at that time, wasn't there?
Not as to any of the non-parties. There was no evidence that there were any warnings provided on any of the products made or sold by those non-parties.
All right.
The jury verdict, because it ignored this uncontroverted evidence, was irrational and grossly unfair. For example, the jury found that Felpro, for whom Ernest Henderson, one of the plaintiffs, testified, sold 99% of the gaskets that were used at the Henderson Automotive Shop, was not liable and bore 0% of the responsibility. Now, not only was the allocation of fault improper, but the trial court should have granted judgment as a matter of law to Dana because of a complete failure of proof that the Victor gaskets, and the Victor gaskets were the product that Dana was held responsible for, but that the Victor gaskets at issue were asbestos-containing, and also that any exposure that Bruce or Elizabeth Henderson experienced from working with Victor gaskets was a substantial factor in causing their mesotheliomas. Now, with respect to the evidence relating to the content of the Victor gaskets, there was no dispute at trial that some Victor gaskets had asbestos, but that some were asbestos-free. And the plaintiffs had the burden to show that the Victor gaskets at issue here were of the asbestos-containing variety. And they did not meet that burden. They offered in that regard no direct evidence of the sort that you might see in the typical asbestos case. They didn't introduce any invoices showing that the automotive shop purchased asbestos-containing Victor gaskets. They didn't offer any testimony showing that Bruce Henderson ever removed an asbestos-containing Victor gasket. In fact, Bruce Henderson could not testify that he ever removed a Victor gasket at all. He was unaware of the identity of the gaskets he removed. And they offered no testimony that the trade names that were associated with the Victor gaskets used at the shop were consistent with the trade names that Dana used on its asbestos-containing Victor gaskets. Instead, the plaintiffs relied on circumstantial evidence. But plaintiff's circumstantial evidence here required the jury to make a leap of faith to conclude that the Victor gaskets at issue were asbestos-containing. For example, the plaintiffs introduced into evidence a 1980 article by a Dana engineer named John Zeitz that was published in an automotive trade journal and stated the majority of gaskets sold in the United States contained asbestos. It didn't speak to Victor gaskets, and it didn't speak to the market in Louisiana or gaskets sold to the Henderson shop. And the article, therefore, does not provide any link between the gaskets that are at issue in this case and Victor asbestos-containing gaskets.
That was argued to the jury?
I believe it was. Yes, Your Honors. And it was pure speculation for the jury to conclude from that article, or to allow the jury to conclude from the article, that the Victor gaskets at issue contained asbestos, given that, as I said, not all Victor gaskets contained asbestos. There was testimony that not all of
what
the gaskets...
What percentage did? Was that...
There was no evidence as to the percentage as to Victor gaskets. There was evidence, however, that not all of the gaskets used at the automotive shop were asbestos-containing. And most importantly, there was evidence from, again, plaintiff Ernest Henderson that 99% of the gaskets used at the Henderson shop were made by Felpro. And there was also testimony that they used other brands of gaskets aside from Victor and Felpro. And allowing speculation by the jury in these circumstances effectively and improperly shifted the burden to Dana to prove that the gaskets at issue were asbestos-free. And more generally, it allowed the jury to impose liability on Dana based on statistics, evidence about the majority of gaskets in the United States, rather than any evidence showing a link between Bruce and Elizabeth Henderson and the Victor asbestos-containing gaskets here. And that's like market share liability and is not permitted. Now, turning last to the question of substantial factor causation, plaintiff's theory at trial was that every exposure to asbestos is a substantial factor. But that theory is wrong as a matter of Louisiana law, which requires evidence of a significant exposure to asbestos in order to establish substantial factor causation. And thus, Louisiana, as well as other courts considering the substantial factor causation standard, have held that the every exposure theory does not by itself prove substantial factor causation. And that's true in the Sixth Circuit decision in the Moeller case, which we brought to the court's attention last week. Instead, what the cases hold is you need to compare the exposure at issue to the totality of the exposures experienced by the plaintiff or the decedent to determine whether or not the exposure at issue is trivial, like a bucket of water would be to the volume of water in the ocean, is how the Sixth Circuit put it. And the Victor exposure here is like that proverbial bucket of water. Thus, at most 1% of the exposure to asbestos from gaskets experienced by Elizabeth and Bruce is attributable to Victor. And again, that's because of Ernest Henderson's 99% of the gaskets were used by Felpro testimony and the existence of, we know that they used other brands. But that gasket exposure itself was only a fraction of the total exposure experienced by the Hendersons. In that regard, the jury found that they were exposed to asbestos from brakes and joint compounds and clutches. Plaintiff's expert testified that the potential exposure to asbestos from brakes and joint compounds was 4 to 6 times higher than the potential exposure to asbestos from gaskets. And the jury also found that Bruce and Elizabeth Henderson were exposed to asbestos from living in the neighborhood of a Johns Manville manufacturing facility that made asbestos-containing products. But because plaintiffs relied at trial on their every exposure theory, they offered no evidence relating to the frequency with which Elizabeth or Bruce were exposed to asbestos from Victor gaskets, and they offered no evidence comparing their exposure to asbestos from Victor gaskets to their total overall exposure. And it was precisely those types of circumstances, or that sort of a circumstance, that led the Sixth Circuit in that Moeller case to say that a different gasket manufacturer was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. I've gone over my time, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Timothy Halsey on behalf of Zoom Performance Products, a trade name of Perfection High Test Company. For ease of reference, I will refer to it as Zoom. Zoom adopts the arguments just presented by Dana Corporation, and in addition to the arguments that it has made in its briefing on appeal, I'd like to focus on 2 points that pleases the Court. First, respectfully, the trial court erred by not following Louisiana law and the cited precedent that we presented to the Court. Specifically, the trial court reasoned in its opinion the plaintiffs were not required to provide testimony or evidence establishing the origins of the Zoom clutches to which Bruce and Elizabeth Henderson were exposed, nor the exact dates and numbers of exposures. However, Louisiana law requires a plaintiff to demonstrate not only exposure to a defendant's asbestos-containing product, but also that such exposure occurred with the frequency and regularity such that it constitutes a substantial contributing factor to plaintiff's asbestos-related injury. There was no such sufficient evidence presented at trial to satisfy this burden. Neither Bruce, through his videotape testimony, nor Ernie Henderson, testifying at trial, could say that the Zoom clutches that they recall installing contained asbestos. Similarly, plaintiff's experts, Dr. Barry Castleman, their industrial hygienist, William Ewing, and Mary Finn, testified that either they had no opinion or could not state whether the Zoom clutches in question contained asbestos. In fact, despite serving as experts in hundreds, and in Dr. Castleman's case, thousands of asbestos cases, he had never heard of Zoom before this case. Louisiana law is consistent with Delaware law on this point, as spelled out in the Timmons and Stigliano cases. When a defendant's product alternatively included asbestos-containing component parts and non-asbestos-containing component parts, and there's no evidence presented as to which the plaintiff was exposed, The jury cannot be left to speculate or guess which product was used, and judgment must be entered in defendant's favor. Even if the Zoom clutches in question are assumed to have contained asbestos or asbestos component parts, there was very little evidence introduced that would establish the necessary frequency and regularity requirement. There was not a single invoice of a Zoom clutch introduced. There was no identification of where the Zoom clutches would have been purchased, because it was uncontroverted that Zoom clutches were not sold in Louisiana during the time period. So it somehow indirectly made it to Louisiana, but no one could testify as to where they came from. Ernie testified that on average, the shops, the two Henderson shops, installed one clutch a week, but the high-performance racing clutches that Zoom made and other defendants made up only 1% of that clutch work. Thus, if you do the calculation, that's on average one Zoom clutch per year was installed at the Henderson shops. Zoom submits that this is not the frequency and regularity requirement that Louisiana law requires. Even if Ernie or Mrs. Henderson were around every one of those installations or did the installations themselves, one clutch, Zoom clutch a year would not be sufficient.
And is that evidence uncontradicted?
Well, it's uncontradicted, Your Honor, in this way. The industrial hygienist, William Ewing, that took the stand on behalf of the plaintiffs, I specifically asked him on cross-examination whether he was able to do a dose analysis with respect to Zoom clutches. He said that he could not do that analysis because he was not given the necessary, what he called, frequency and duration information to do a dose analysis. So their experts could not demonstrate or opine or even testify as to what level of exposure would have been presented to the Hendersons if, in fact, there was one Zoom clutch job done a year. And if Mr. Ewing could not opine as to frequency and duration, Zoom submits the jury could only speculate as well as to frequency and regularity under Louisiana law. The second point I'd like to address, and alternatively, is respectfully the trial court erred or abused its discretion by not allocating 12 viral shares based on plaintiffs' judicial admissions regarding the nine non-trial defendants and the uncontroverted evidence about the liability of those defendants. Plaintiffs made a strategic decision. I actually submit that it was a good decision on their part. Throughout the case, they presented evidence and statements about these non-trial defendants in their opening argument, in their closing argument, and throughout the evidence. They pointed out the liability of these non-trial defendants. We submit, Zoom submits, that these are legal admissions and concessions that take that issue away from the jury. And it seems to me that the reason plaintiffs made this strategic decision is it provided credibility with the jury, and it made it appear as if they were not overreaching when they went after Zoom and Dana, to which they had very little evidence. These admissions we submit are clear and specific. Plaintiffs refer to these nine non-trial defendants by name and indicated that they were the cause of plaintiffs' injuries. So based on those admissions, we submit that 12 viral shares should be allocated among these parties.
And did you ask the trial court to do that?
We did, Your Honor, and we were overruled on that request. We did so at the close of evidence. We did so in our post-trial briefing as well. And, Your Honors, I would submit that such an allocation would be just as well, because prior to the trial, plaintiffs reached their peace with these nine trial defendants. This would avoid duplicate recoveries. My time is up. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Jerome Block on behalf of Appalese and Cross Appellants. I'll start out with the argument with respect to the non-parties, because that's what Dana's counsel started with. There's two main reasons why the arguments of the appellants fails with respect to the non-parties. First, the argument that's being made to this court rests on a premise that the evidence against these nine non-parties for which liability was not found was not materially different than the liability for the companies that the jury did find liability on, and those companies were Dana, Zoom, and Johns Manville. The jury found the evidence to be materially different, and so did Judge Abelman in ruling on the JNOV motions. And if I could point out a few things. First of all, we presented evidence that Dana actually did not warn. We didn't just rest on evidence that Bruce Henderson decades ago did not remember seeing any warnings. We actually presented evidence, first of all, through our expert witness, that he recalled that Dana had not started warning until 1984, and that was after the Henderson's auto shop had closed. We also presented evidence that as late as 1982, Dana had declined to purchase warning labels for asbestos that one of their suppliers was suggesting that they buy for $45 for 1,000 labels. And they clearly say, we are not warning. We are not interested in buying those warning labels. We also presented evidence that Dana in 1973 was warning corporate clients like General Motors, who, after General Motors requested a warning because there was asbestos dust that would come out of the product packaging, and General Motors was finding that that was exposing their workers to asbestos, and we introduced correspondence where they asked Dana, will you warn on your box of gaskets that you're sending to our company, and Dana said they would. So we showed that Dana, in fact, did not warn. Dana declined to warn even when their suppliers were suggesting it and even when they were warning corporate customers. Now, Zoom, we presented evidence through their corporate representative who incidentally did not come in to testify in the defense case. Zoom did not present any evidence in their defense case. We presented page and line designations from pretrial depositions of Mr. Stevens, Zoom's corporate representatives, and he admitted that they never warned. They, in fact, never warned. We also showed, and this is in response to Justice Ridgely's question. Justice Ridgely asked counsel, wasn't there evidence that some members of the industry were, in fact, warning during the relevant time period? And the answer is yes, there was such evidence. In our appendix that we submitted in opposition to Zoom's appeal at B116 and 117, and also at B350 and 357, through 357, we presented evidence that Zoom's, one of their main suppliers for the clutch facings that contained asbestos, was providing warnings on their product packaging to customers and to other companies such as Zoom, who would take their clutch facings, put it onto their clutches, and then repackage them. So we showed not only that Zoom, in fact, failed to warn, but that they were actually being warned by one of their main suppliers that the clutch facings contain asbestos and that you have to take precautions to avoid breathing in asbestos dust. But Zoom did not pass those warnings on to its own customers. They actually took the clutch facings out of the packaging from Raybestos, repackaged them in Zoom product packaging, and in fact took the warning, didn't pass the warning on. Similarly, Johns Manville, the defendants made a strategic decision here. Johns Manville was not a company that was implicated in these automotive exposures like these two defendants. Johns Manville was a different type of exposure altogether. It involved alleged environmental exposure that the Hendersons had from living in a community near a Johns Manville plant for certain years in the 1950s and 1960s. So rather than put on evidence against other members of the automotive industry, rather than risk being perceived as blaming the very exposures that they were claiming to the jury were not causative, they made a strategic decision to try to blame Johns Manville, and Johns Manville also was a company that used crocidolite asbestos, which was different than the chrysotile asbestos that they claimed unsuccessfully did not cause mesothelioma. So this was a strategic decision. Judge Abelman, the way she put it in denying the motion for a new trial as to the non-parties, said that this was an effort to cobble together evidence in retrospect to do something that wasn't done during the case. Because when we compare the evidence against these nine non-parties, where the jury carefully found, yes, there was exposure to those other nine parties, but there was no evidence about whether those other companies, in fact, warned or did not warn. And There was no evidence. For example, all of these nine parties, as counsel notes, were involved in this litigation. If these companies wanted to present evidence that these companies warned, did not warn, inadequately warned, they could have introduced their answers to interrogatories. There was evidence that they could have introduced showing whether some of them warned, some of them didn't. But that evidence was not introduced. So it was not irrational for the jury to say that they believed that we had met our burden of showing no warnings against Dana and Zoom, that the defendants themselves had met their burden of showing no warnings from Johns Manville. And the evidence was that Johns Manville, they distributed their product. It was scrap from their plant.
Well, the strategic decision that you're referring to was a decision to show that the cancer that eventually caused the death of the two plaintiffs came from environmental sources, namely John Mansville, and not from the clutches or from the gaskets, that is, from anything that happened inside the shop. And it was strategic because that also happened to be congruent with their main defense against liability.
Correct. I couldn't agree more, and even went beyond that. They called a witness to actually tell the jury what Johns Manville actually did, which is they would truck this scrap material out of their plant, distribute it out into the community without any warning. So the jury had evidence that these three companies, in fact, did not warn. And when you look at these other companies, there's no evidence about what Honeywell did or did not do, what Napa did or did not do. The other reason why this argument fails is that it rests on the premise that Mr. Henderson's lack of recall of warnings is uncontroverted evidence that the other companies, in fact, did not warn. Now, if they had introduced answers to interrogatories from Napa or Honeywell saying that they never warned, and I introduced no evidence in response to that, that would be uncontroverted evidence that those companies, in fact, did not warn. But counsel is confusing uncontroverted evidence that Mr. Henderson did not remember warnings with the concept of uncontroverted evidence about whether such warnings were made at all. So Judge Abelman found significant differences, she said, in the quality and quantity of evidence. And as she pointed out, this is not a question. If the jury had found in favor of these nine companies, then the question on appeal would be, was the evidence sufficient to sustain that jury's finding?
Well, what's your response to Mr. Housel's argument that there were legal admissions by counsel?
My response is that when you look at the case law from this court, cases like the Merritt case, those were admissions on specific factual issues. In the Merritt case, the employer admitted the factual issue that the employee was partially disabled for a specific time period.
When you say admission, do you mean a formal admission in a pleading or in a request for admission?
Yes, I do. So, but even if we assume that argument by counsel could be deemed a judicial admission, and I think that may not be the case, even if we assume that, if you look at the argument that was made, it was that there was exposure to other products, that all these exposures substantially contributed to the mesotheliomas, but I specifically said in closing that we don't know we haven't heard evidence about what these other companies did or didn't do, and I said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it's up to you to determine whether defendants have met their burden of showing fault, which is different than exposure, on behalf of the non-party. So I think for those reasons, this is not a judicial admission on par with the holding in Merritt. And so the issue was for the jury. So now moving on to the next issue that was raised in this oral argument. The evidence, first of all, three times in counsel for Dana's oral argument, they said that the evidence was that there was 99% of the gaskets were Felpro. Well, of course, that's viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the moving party on JNOV. In fact, Bruce Henderson testified.
I'm sorry, are we on the next issue now, the substantial, regular and...
Yeah, if the court would like me to cover anything else on the non-parties, I'd be glad to.
All right, well, if we're in that second issue, that is basically the adequacy of the evidence of the legal sufficiency of the evidence.
Yes.
Is it necessary for this court to resolve what appears to be an issue as to what the Louisiana law is?
Not at all. If we look, we have the Rondo case, R-A-N-D-O. And in the Rondo case, 2009, the Louisiana Supreme Court said that in order to sustain a case in a mesothelioma case, you have to show that the asbestos exposure at issue was a substantial factor in causing injury. Now, in that case, Louisiana Supreme Court, 2009, the court specifically noted that mesothelioma is a disease that can be caused by fairly short exposures. The court referenced testimony at page 1091 and 1092 of that opinion of a Dr. Brody for the plaintiff who testified that mesothelioma is a dose-response disease and that the more you're exposed, the more your risk is. They talked about Dr. Lemon's exposure at page 1091 and 1092, that there is no safe level of asbestos exposure for mesothelioma. So far from rejecting the notion that limited exposures to asbestos can cause mesothelioma, that was accepted quite clearly in the Rando case, which is the binding substantive law on the issue of proximate cause in the case. And that case involved a person who had several years of exposure as a bystander to work with asbestos insulation products. This case involves people who had exposure for 3 decades. I mean, the auto shops at issue in this case, these automotive products were being used from the 1950s up and through the early 1980s. And the cases that were cited by the appellants suggesting that you need some kind of prolonged exposure is not borne out in the Rando case. In fact, if you look at the Egan case, which was an interim level opinion in 1996.
Well, the question I ask is whether we need to resolve that. Let me ask it
differently. Absolutely not.
If we were to assume that the defendants are right, that there has to be regular and frequent exposure, was that test satisfied here?
I think that you do not need to show a specific quantum of exposure, and I think that's clear in Rando. But even if we were required to show that, the answer is that we did show it, and that's exactly what Judge Abelman said in denying the J&OV motions. The evidence was that Bruce Henderson testified that Victor was one of the main brands, was one of the three main brands used. So yes, Ernie Henderson may have said that he remembered Felpro being 99%, but this is a factual issue. And Bruce Henderson said that Victor was one of the main three brands. Bruce Henderson also testified that gasket work was constantly being done, and they were an engine rebuilding shop. Similarly, with respect to the clutches, Ernie Henderson testified at trial that the Zoom clutches were the standard brand and the best brand when they were working on hot rods, and that was a big thing that they did. In fact, there's a funny line from the transcript where Mr. Ernie Henderson says that those clutches were bad. And what he was saying was, and he clarified in the record, those were the best clutches. He wouldn't use anything else for that application. So we're not talking, Justice Jacobs, about a situation where someone changes the clutch on their own car once or twice. We're talking about people who worked in an automotive shop over a period of 3 decades, and these are one of the brands of clutches used, and these are one of the brands of gasket used. And so Judge Abelman, in her opinion, talks about that the job of the trial court is really to rule out de minimis exposures,
well,
if anything. But
what is the plaintiff's response to the argument that was made by Zoom's counsel that the actual proof showed at most exposure to one Zoom clutch a year that was installed in the Henderson shop?
Well, I don't think that that's at all resolving the factual issues in the light most favorable to the non-movement on J&OV. The testimony was that clutch work was done on a regular basis. There was one line of testimony where Mr. Henderson said that they may have done clutches once a week at the second auto shop, when the second auto shop was open. But there was also testimony by Ernie Henderson that the work on the hot rods, the cars that you would put special engines in and to drive fast on the street, that Zoom was the dominant standard brand for that type of car, and that was all you would use. And that included both the clutches that the Hendersons would use on their own cars for those applications and also for customers. So so I believe that the response is that that would take the testimony in the light most favorable to the moving party when the law requires the opposite.
Okay, so there was controverted evidence on frequency and regularity.
Yes.
As to Zoom, and the evidence that supported the plaintiffs, you know, showed more frequency and more regularity.
Yes, and I think Judge Abelman really details that in her denial of J&OV. Just on the presence of asbestos itself in the products, because that was talked about, it's important to know that Mr. Henderson talked about four applications in which gaskets were used. One was the head gasket, and then there were the manifold gaskets and the pipe flange gaskets. And it was those applications that were issue at this trial. And Mr. Zietz, in the 1980 article, said that exhaust manifold gaskets and flange gasket required asbestos. And he wrote that in his official capacity as the chief of the Victor Division of the Dana Corporation. And as Judge Abelman found, a jury can certainly reasonably infer from that statement that those types of gaskets during that time period would have had asbestos in it. Mr. Zietz also wrote an internal memo at the same time saying that asbestos had not been taken out of gaskets because of economic drawbacks. Now, counsel says that Dana made gaskets with asbestos and without asbestos. Well, the only evidence that Dana cited in this whole record that they made any gasket in those applications that the Henderson used other than asbestos were these all-metal gaskets, which are on B484 and B485 of the appendix we submitted in opposition to Dana's appeal. But this is not a metal gasket case, because as Mr. Ewing, our certified industrial hygienist, explained, you're not going to grind off a Dana metal gasket. You're going to grind off a gasket that contains asbestos that's been fused to the engine from the heat. Mr. Ewing explained that the head gaskets, the manifold gaskets, the applications that were used here were used on hot surfaces, and these were the ones that would have to be ground off, and that metal gaskets would just pop off. So this is a case in which the applications that were talked about by Bruce Henderson match up with those gaskets that Victor made that contain asbestos. And there is evidence that Victor gaskets were both handled, causing exposure, packages were open, causing exposure, and also Victor gaskets were removed, causing exposure. And as Judge Abelman found in denying J&OV, the jury could have reasonably inferred that if Victor was one of the main brands of gaskets that were being installed, given that these auto shops were in a rural community where they had many repeat customers, and given that they were also working on their own cars, that many times they would be removing the same gaskets that they had previously installed. So the evidence shows, and even Mary Finn, Dana's own expert, at B392 of the record we submitted in opposition to Dana's appeal, at B392 she admits that gaskets in these applications, particularly exhaust manifold and intake manifold, did contain asbestos. Similarly, with Zoom, we certainly showed that the products contained asbestos. Is that full 20? Okay. We showed that the Zoom clutches contain asbestos. It looks like I'm running short on time. I need to address damages. I would just point out to this honorable court that the zero damages award for Bruce Henderson for the loss of his mother is per se inadequate under Mayer v. Santucci. I would point out to this court that there is no basis to uphold an $80,000 damages award for the pain and suffering of someone who had mesothelioma.
I have a question for you. There was a motion before Judge Abelman regarding eligibility for the loss of consortium under Louisiana law. Was that ever ruled upon?
It was not ever ruled, or if I may have permission to answer.
Yes, go ahead.
It was not ever ruled on, and I would direct the court's attention to Article 2315.1A3, A3, which says that damages that are personal to a person survive the person's death and in favor of siblings. So even though Bruce Henderson had no wife or kids, it survives in favor of siblings, and that's what it says in that subsection.
Well, my point is, even if we agree with you that $0 is inadequate, there's still an outstanding legal issue that the trial court has not addressed on the eligibility to obtain that damage. Is that right?
I agree.
So would a remand be appropriate in that instance?
I think a remand would be appropriate in that instance, and also for the court to apply the correct legal standard in looking at Mrs. Henderson's pain and suffering and not aggregating when looking at the damages.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Excuse me. I want to address a couple of the points that Mr. Block said.
Do you agree with his last point that a remand would be appropriate if we agreed with him that the zero award was inadequate?
I mean, I think you could decide the legal question yourselves as well. It's a legal issue, but I think it would be fine to remand it back to the trial court as well to have them decide that legal question. It is an open question. Mr. Block argued in connection with your question to me as to whether there was any warnings on any of the 9 non-party products, that there was evidence about warnings. But the only evidence he pointed to was evidence about warnings on Raybestos brakes, and Raybestos was not one of the 9 parties. And I recited to you all of the evidence that Bruce Henderson gave as to why from which one could conclude there was no warnings on any of these products. And if it was the only reasonable inference from that had to be that there was no warnings on the non-party products, because if you could infer that there were warning labels on the non-party products, that would mean that Bruce Henderson ignored warnings, and thus the jury could not have found a failure to warn on the part of Dana and Zoom was a cause of the injury, and the jury was expressly asked or told that they had to find that to impose liability on Dana. With regard to the Johns Manville question and the argument that Dana and Zoom made a strategic decision to argue about Johns Manville and not focus on the non-parties, absolutely there was evidence offered as to Johns Manville. But Dana and Zoom also made the alternative argument that the non-parties were also at fault. And during closing arguments, Dana's lawyer stood up and said the evidence as to the non-parties is the same. It's the same plaintiff's experts, Dr. Castleman, Dr. Welch, Mr. Ewing, if you believe their testimony as to us, you have to believe it as to the non-parties. It shows you have to reach the same conclusions. And so the evidence was identical as to all of the parties. And then on the substantial factor question, you asked whether there was actually evidence of frequent exposure to asbestos. And Mr. Block responded by talking generally about the work with gaskets and clutches at the automotive shop over the years that it was in business. But the key here is whether there was evidence of significant exposure or frequent and regular exposure to Dana or Victor gaskets and Zoom clutches. And he didn't speak to that issue, and there was no evidence. And as to Dana in particular, there was no testimony from anybody that Bruce Henderson ever removed a Victor gasket. And according to plaintiff's expert, Mr. Ewing, that was the source of asbestos exposure. Bruce was asked the question several times, and every time he said, I cannot tell. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And thank you all for your arguments. And the court will take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a short recess.